12. Shoreham Cross.
Images 27 and 28.
These are two of the topographical drawings I made in 1828 at the request of Mr. Linnell. Look at the second image. By walking around, you might be able to find the exact spot in the field from which I made the drawing. Can you see the church where we started, and the bridge over the river with the weald stretching out into the distance? The roof of Waterhouse, where I lived, is peeping out above some trees to the left of the bridge. As time went on, I found my life in Shoreham increasingly difficult to sustain. The other ancients were getting on with their own lives and careers, and could not come and go as they once had. I was lonely and longed for a wife. I was also pinched by a most unpoetical and unpastoral kind of poverty, and the sad realities of life blotted my vision. Every year I submitted works to the Royal Academy. Some years they were accepted for exhibition, but I never succeeded in winning any sort of critical acclaim or selling even one picture.
Image 29.
Perhaps this painting by Cruikshank of the Royal Academy Summer Exhibition might give you an idea of why my little paintings didn't get noticed. I had purchased some cottages in Shoreham with my legacy, but the meagre rent was not enough to live on, so I was forced to look for some other source of income. In 1832, I bought a house in Grove Street in London and began to earn a living by teaching young ladies the rudiments of drawing and painting in watercolour. Although I returned to Shoreham whenever I could, there was now another reason to keep me in London. I had become increasingly fond of Annie, the eldest daughter of John Linnell, who I had known since she was a child, and I was overjoyed to find that she returned my affections. We married in 1837 and spent our honeymoon in Italy. My days in the Valley of Vision were over. And what of those Shoreham paintings? Realizing that they were too odd for the popular tastes of the day, I put them away in what I termed my portfolio of curiosities, with a wife and children to support, and my father-in-law, Linnell, always on my back. I lost faith in my visionary art and began to make much more conventional paintings, hoping in this way to struggle up into repute. But I always valued those pictures, viewing them with great nostalgia, and from time to time I would give them away as gifts to those I thought might recognize their worth. My only surviving child, Herbert, was sadly limited in his appreciation of my work, finding much of it embarrassingly eccentric. He was ashamed at the open way I expressed my feelings in my letters and sketchbooks, and thought that I wasn't sufficiently reticent. After I died, he had a huge bonfire. All but one of my Shoreham sketchbooks, and goodness knows what else, went up in flames. Poor boy. He thought he was protecting my reputation. I had ensured that Herbert had the rigorously academic art education that I came to feel that I had sorely lacked. But in doing so, I had inadvertently contributed to the destruction of my most imaginative and experimental work. He maintained that no one would be able to make head or tail of it, and wanted to save it from a more humiliating fate. Maybe I shouldn't be so harsh on him, for although I cannot concur with all his opinions, it was he who wrote my first biography and was active in keeping the interest of my work alive. He encouraged Martin Hardy at the Victoria and Albert Museum to have some of my etchings reprinted, and helped in the planning of an exhibition at the museum in 1926, entitled Drawings, Etchings and Woodcuts by Samuel Palmer and Other Disciples of William Blake. It was a huge success. Suddenly everyone was talking about me. Tastes change, and it was my Shoreham pictures which were attracting all the attention. They were seen as daringly expressive and unconventional, and they resonated with the modernist ideas of the time.
Images 30.
I became a very important influence on a group of British painters in the first half of the 20th century called the Neo-Romantics. Among them were Graham Sutherland, Paul Nash, and John Piper. And they were followed by a younger generation of artists, including John Minton and John Craxton. They were struck by the way I had made my pastoral landscapes a vehicle for a psychological inner state, and shared with me a mystical appreciation of nature. I was brought very low by some grievous sorrows in my life. But, despite everything, I continued to paint. In my later years, I found great solace in the practice of etching.
Image 31.
There, in my small study, among my inks and galley pots, I worked tirelessly on a series of etchings based on two poems by Milton, L'Allegro and Il Penseroso. In them, I feel I retrieved, albeit in a more melancholy strain, some of that dreamy, mystic glimmer of my Shoreham works. Even though our artistic practices diverged, a group of us ancients would continue to meet once a month. And what convivial evenings they were! Richmond, who was there at my deathbed, remained the very closest of friends. He was scornful of our youthful idealism, and used to say we all wanted thumping when we thought, in a dream of sentiment, we were learning art. But I felt differently. I looked back very fondly on my time in Shoreham, that genuine village where I mused away some of the best years of my life.